Chancellor Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, from subscribers to our online community of thinkers, and from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed
or misexpressed
on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and explore our library of nearly 600 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Saul's kind of faith is a gift. It's like an ear for music or the talent to draw. He believes, and you can use logic on him all day long, and he still believes.
Must everything be logical?
You've been listening to Philosophy Talk on 89.3 WHFR.FM. Up and coming next is the WHFR Journal.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
This is the WHFR Journal. Welcome, Susan McGraw here on this May the 31st, the final day of the month of May. We're so happy that you're here with us and hope you're staying cool and enjoying what this season is offering. We are circling back in today's show to finish up a discussion panel that we started last week. It's called Censorship in Education, and this panel took place earlier this month, the 10th of May, in fact, at Christ Episcopal Church in Dearborn, and it was designed to be an event to raise awareness about educational policy and the effects of censorship. Now, on this panel include 15th District Representative Aaron Burns, student researcher Zina Al-Jahawi, and Dearborn librarian Nicole Allward. This is an event sponsored by the League of Women Voters, Dearborn, Dearborn Heights. So let's get back into it, and we will run this in its entirety. This is Censorship in Education, and we're going to jump right into the next question.
So that actually leads me to my next question for my panelists. What are some of the misconceptions that people have about what librarians do in terms of selection of content? And I will let you guys
answer. This is one of my favorite questions because I feel like as a school librarian, lots of people don't know what we actually do frequently. One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that we're also certified teachers. So we're teacher librarians. So we have a lot of roles, which means we get moved around from school to school as well. So people think that every book in the library, I picked it out and I know what's on the shelf, and that is not the case. I've been in Dearborn schools for 6 years, and I've worked in six different schools. I've been at Edsel Ford the whole time. But we had people that were getting all these accusations, and they had been in the school for about 2 months. And so they're like, is that book there? They're like, I don't know. I barely know where the bathroom is. And it was the assumption that we know where everything is. I'll tell people, I was like, there's like 20,000 books in Edsel Ford's library. There could be things I don't know about, even after 6 years. They think that we've read all the books in the library, that we read every book that we order, and we can't. We depend on professional reviews and aid recommendations, but those reviewers are still people also, and that is why we have that challenge process, because people may disagree with those reviews, and that's okay, and that's why we have the committee that can read a book and decide, do we agree with that? That's why it's there. But the expectation that we've read everything personally, I was like, we don't have any time to read at work. We're teaching, we're doing all of these things, and that was something that always surprises people.
And so just to clarify, the librarians in the schools are teacher librarians. I opted out of teaching. I have two littles now, and I'm appreciative of those who. And I do have to say that with that local parentis, I applaud any person who is willing to put their self in the line of fire in schools and school libraries in particular, due to this conflict of a very contentious situation where parental rights are the key factor as a parent. Let that be known. But as we go with selecting content, she is correct. Most libraries and librarians are well equipped with our own reviewed resources that we review on top of their reviews. Then we go and see, is this fit for our community? Is this just another James Patterson? Everybody knows he has his whole section in every library. Or is it a one-off that may or may not get a hit? Part of the issue that librarians have to weigh is it's not our money. For the public librarians, we are very well aware it's not our money. This is something that I've heard in government is a healthy budget, and I squash that. There's no such thing as a healthy budget in a library. Everything can be taken from us at any time by those who we are supposed to be serving. And I take that very seriously. So when we select materials for our collections, the first person we're thinking about is our community and who it encapsulates. One of the things as a public library director that I am advocating for is public engagement and feedback. You tell me that you saw on TikTok this book that's coming out in 2025 and you send it to our recommendation form on our website, or you even chat with me, Jerry's my contact, any of you have any recommendations? Genuinely, we're at the end of the budget, we're trying to spend it. You can recommend all the books you'd like. And then we see if it's available in our community. If it's made by a patron, I've told my staff, we want to support what our interests are of our community. Those are priority. And then the other reviews and things like that, we weigh against what we're seeing and what we're seeing checked out. So we're also looking at the data behind our previous engagements with our communities and what they're using to help influence what we buy in the future. So there's a lot of factors that librarians weigh. They are accountants, they are the reviewers, and they are also the ones who determine, well, these patrons I know will come in and that romance section is always popping, this is gonna go. Versus well, this is a spiritual book about how to use urine to cure cancer. That is a real request. It really did get added because actually the doctor was a certified doctor. There was no other reason to not add it because it was a patron request. Guess what? That book went around the state of Michigan through Interloan. It was a hotcake. I don't understand. So just so you're aware, this helps not only your community, but it helps us in understand all communities within the system because we are one of the most connected states. So I want to let you know that in this COP talk. With our Interloan system, we are connected with over 400 institute libraries across our state. That is not in every state, and that is a very good benefit. And so one of the things that I key focus on is that Interloan and that exchange of materials to see, is it all the materials that we're buying, are we actually supporting our communities, or should we be letting Grand Haven know that they've got a really big fan in this psychedelic mushroom era, you know? That's the type of thing, but that's what we do. So there's a lot of layers to what we do, and that's one of the factors for purchasing.
Thank you both so much for sharing that perspective. Another thing is libraries do so much for their patrons. I know people think the main thing is books, but you also offer digital media, printing. People, when they're job searching, can go to the library and get help with their applications. In Michigan, we have the Michigan Activity Pass. If you're not familiar with it, it's this amazing program with your library card. You can get access to state parks, you can get access to museums, a lot of amazing places for free with your library card. And that's some of the amazing things that libraries do in Michigan. My next question is for Erin. What do you believe is the role and responsibility of legislators when it comes to protecting libraries and educational content?
Thank you. That's a great question. So I'll start by saying, on a very just fundamental note, there absolutely is a role for state legislators to play in this arena. I think it's really important. And I'll start by sharing, you know, in Michigan, we have several bills that are in the works in the House right now. They haven't been introduced yet. But they would really help outline, we're calling it kind of like freedom to read. And it would really help outline processes for librarians throughout the state of Michigan in the event that a book is challenged, that there's a request to ban a book or remove it from a shelf. So those are in process right now. So I'll share more on those as they, you know, kind of come to pass in the coming months and are ultimately introduced. But those are in the works. I'm also looking at ways that we can protect, you know, teachers, librarians from harassment, from threats. You know, again, tragically, we've seen an uptick in that, you know, over the past several years. We hope that that ends, you know, yesterday. It should have never happened, but it is something that's occurring. So we're looking at that. Folks may have seen that passed through the Elections Committee in the House, I think it was last year. We had passed a bill that would kind of strengthen, you know, the laws around threatening or harassing poll workers, right, for our elections. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of looking into something similar for our teachers and our librarians, because all of these things are connected, right? The censorship movement, when it comes to books in public libraries, school libraries, little free libraries, maybe, you never know, right? Everything's on the chopping block.
Yeah.
And then when we also think of, you know, folks who don't want people to vote, right? All of these things are connected. So we're looking at that in the legislature. If we're looking at protecting elections workers, how can we translate that to protect our librarians in whichever type of space that they may be in? And the last thing I'll mention, this is something that Illinois did, I think it was last year. They were kind of known as the first state to ban book banning. And the way that they have done that was to pass legislation that would say, you know, if you are like a library space that receives public funding, state funding, and you are out there banning books and, you know, you're caving to these calls for censorship, that you would no longer be eligible for that state funding. So it's a way to say you cannot do this and continue to receive backing from the state. Again, that's in Illinois. That hasn't come up in Michigan yet, but that is something that's out there in that legislative ecosystem.
Thank you, Erin. My next question is from all my panelists. What mechanisms do you believe should be in place to handle disputes over educational content?
One of the things that kind of backfired last year is that we were in the middle of reapproving our book reconsideration process. It was like on the August retreats agenda to reapprove, and we hadn't really changed that much. And then it didn't get finalized, and they kept adding to it. So the process is longer than it was. So I always say having a good process in place is essential. And once we got there, it's been great, because what we've added is collaboration between the libraries. So if you go to one library, you're going to get the same answer as another. And no one makes a decision based just on their opinion, because we have three high schools and like seven middle schools. And so when we have something brought to us, we're like, I understand, and we listen, and then we get together and we look at it and decide as a group so that we're not pitted against each other. So it was what had in place?
Mechanisms.
And so that was one of the things that really, then no one gets targeted individually also because of that. And now we also have a better communication process, so if something happens, everyone knows about it. And I think that was a change, because we were kind of like little islands before, and now we're much more unified. So that was a good thing that came out of it. Unfortunately, it came, there was a lot of information, misinformation, because the process hadn't been approved yet. I don't know why we just didn't use the old one, but it didn't happen that way. So people assumed that we didn't have anything, and that got spread around. Mm-hmm. So I did share with the superintendent, I believe, the process from 1972. I found an old copy, and I was like, look, it's not much different. This has been around for a long time. We follow these steps. And having everyone know the process is the other mechanism, is that no one gets caught off guard. And I think I've said this to every person I talk to about this, because I could see the storm coming, and I was just like, we should really share this with everyone. We really have to do this. And it was kind of back burnered a lot. They're like, yeah, it'll be okay, you know, and then it wasn't. And they were like, Nicole, what are we going to do? I was like, so I always said being prepared and making sure everyone knows what to do. At librarians, we like practice. If someone brings you a book and they don't agree with how to respond, you like role play it, because it is, when someone brings it to you, you suddenly you're like, you need to know the vocabulary to assure them that we're listening, and but without saying, you know, just agreeing to take it off the shelf, because it needs to go through the process. Right.
Yeah, that request for reconsideration form. If you don't remember anything else about censorship in libraries, that is the most important form to libraries on this subject, because that is the form that I'm pretty sure now all libraries are aware. The bell has been rung. So those who hadn't in the past evaluated their policies. So I'm going to take a step back. This is so from the director hat. One of the key things to think about in these roles is risk management and risk assessment. So in a lot of times, libraries are run by librarians. They aren't managers, directors of anything except for what they do, which is everything that we've been trained to do, which is provide information, help the public. The management stuff of like policy, procedure, that stuff is the paperwork we don't like to read or do. That's not our type of paperwork. But that's the type that is required of these roles. And it's a hard sell to librarians who, well, why? I could be talking about this weird book that somebody recommended and I now have to read. It's on my list. I gotta go check it out. To trade in that librarian title for a management or director title is a challenge in this way. And it's being addressed with the universities and schools. I think that they're getting more attuned to that being an issue, but many libraries were caught off guard and they were unknowledgeable of this simple form. If they had it in place before, you know, hindsight's 2020, timing is everything, but knowledge is key. And if now every library is very well aware of all this form, a request for reconsideration, it lays out who is the party that's requesting for the reconsideration. And just as a note for anyone who watches this in the future, identify. Are you a library patron? What is your library card number? Mm-hmm. Or your resident, your address? Because if they're a patron, one, you can verify that. Two, you can also have on the form, are you doing this as a representative of an organization or as an individual? And that gets you two clear, quick answers right there from this one first box of the form. So then you get into the nitty-gritty of what is requested. And oftentimes, as I noted, it's emotional or it is pulled from something. I heard this is this on this page. And then my due diligence is always, as Zena's done for the last 3 years, I've been doing it ever since I heard about book censorship in general. Anytime I hear that title, I've been that 13-year-old my whole life, I find out what that title is, it's on my, I go buy a copy, I make sure that I got it, and I read it, and I evaluate it. And then, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So I'm prepared. I know what books are being challenged, and whatever, if they throw a new one at me, guess what? Oh, that's out? Oh, well, let me go check it out. And then we'll reconvene this conversation. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that if we have the knowledge beforehand and we have the role play. You guys can probably tell I'm a fun person. I like to have fun. Role playing with staff. Oh, my goodness. If you were able to get in their face and just start going at them. As we've all had that McDonald's employee video, we all see how bad people can get. But if you prepare staff appropriately to handle these situations, and you then back them, I say the team mentality is there. I play tennis, so you play in the back, you're the support. If the first person says, got it, and then they say, don't got it, you're running. So that's, as the team, you're supporting one another. So when she says, I'm sorry, that's the form, that's what our policy is. She calls over the supervisor, guess what I'm gonna say? Oh, you're absolutely right, that's totally fair, you have your right to your opinion. Let's fill out this form. Well, I don't wanna fill out a form. Would you like to speak to the director? We'll go get her. Hi. So, again, the united front, and I love hearing that it's throughout the schools as well, but we're getting that our act together in that way, and it's, again, people aren't aware that librarians are the ones who are running it. We are running it because we care. We're not running it because we're politicians. We're running it because we want to serve. The management side is just, okay, we'll do it because we got to get the bills paid, you know. So I think that's a change also that's happening on the library side insofar as the mechanisms. We are reinforcing them, and appropriately so.
And to be fair, I'm not criticizing the people that didn't see it coming because it caught us all, the magnitude of it caught us all off guard.
Exactly.
We were working on it.
And can spiral very quickly.
Yes.
If a policy is not official, you fall on the last one.
Yep.
But that's, again.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. It's management. It's one of those where it falls, yeah.
We all know it very well now.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess one thing that I've learned in my research is for the past 3 years, the majority of these groups that advocate for book banning, some of these groups have over 200 chapters nationwide. They have over hundreds of thousands of members. Some of these groups have existed for years, but 70% of these groups, as identified by PEN America, were formed in 2021 or even more recent than that. This is a very recent, targeted effort towards librarians and our educators. It's very unfortunate to see, and a lot of my research, from what I've learned, is like, it's not spontaneous. This isn't just like parents being concerned. A lot of these are targeted members. A lot of them, some of the legislation that I've seen, one very good aspect of it is you have to have a child in the district, or you have to be living in the district in order to challenge a book in that library. Because there have been instances in Florida where a senior citizen who did not have any children living in did not even live in that district, submitted 1,000 challenges to books in that library. Yes. So I guess my next question would be for Erin. What feedback have you received from educators, school administrators, and librarians about book banning and censorship?
That's a great question. I think that senior citizen in Florida needs to find a new hobby. My goodness. That takes some effort. So I think, you know, in terms of feedback from educators and librarians, and, you know, I take a lot of different meetings in Lansing. I meet with folks from our Michigan Library Association, American Library Association, our local librarians and teachers as well, who do such a phenomenal job. And I will say, you know, I think the feedback on my end has been fairly consistent, and it's usually kind of a two-prong thought process, really. One is, I think, kind of an element of still kind of shock and fear a little bit, because this is shocking, right, that this is happening now. I know we referenced something from, I think, 1972 earlier, right? You tend to think that some of these mechanisms for social control, which is what censorship is about, it is about social control straight up all day, every day. And you would think that a lot of those mechanisms were, you know, decades ago, but they are here and they're at our doorstep. So I do think there's that kind of emotional reaction, and I have that too. So I think there's that. I think there's also a real sense of strength in terms of response to this. And there's a level of organization. I know, you know, our two panelists who serve as librarians just referenced, like, top to bottom, here's what we do, here's our process, here's how we support each other. That's really important. So I think that's part of the feedback, too, is like, one, this is shocking and it's pretty scary at times, but two, we are organized, we are trained professionals, we're here for the right reasons, we want to support our community, we want to engage with people, we want people to have access to information, and access to books that really frame a variety of lived experiences. I think that's really important too. So those are a lot of the things that I hear, right? You have that initial emotional reaction, and then you have, wait a minute, we've got this. We know what we're doing, we know what our processes and procedures are, or what they need to be, right, if there are gaps in that in any way. So I think that's part of the feedback I've heard. And then, as I referenced earlier, you know, we're looking at ways to help just protect and strengthen those laws around classroom teachers, librarians receiving threats,
or being harassed in some of these spaces. And that looks different, I think, across the state of Michigan, depending on the community. Some communities have seen, you know, a rise in the censorship movement far more than others. And as Zena mentioned, a lot of it is organized, right? You would think, oh, you know, maybe it's organic, right? Someone was sitting at home and came across this title and thought, I don't like that. I'm going to go, you know, challenge this at a school library or a public library. But oftentimes it comes from groups like, I got to mention Moms for Liberty, right? I'm sure we're all familiar, right? This is a coordinated effort and it's highly political. I want to be very clear on that. So I don't want to pull any punches there. It's highly political. I could get into that. I know we're at a league event, so I will keep it as nonpartisan as I can. But talk to me after, and I'll share my thoughts on that as
well. My next question for my panelists is, how has issues of book banning and censorship affected your library's operation and policies?
Challenge accepted is the way that I take it. So for the policies and procedures, like I said, I've actually directed at 3 libraries, and at each library it is the first step for me to evaluate all policies and procedures and see what's in play and who knows what's in play, because there's also different, you know, there's older policies and there's some who are like, no, that is the policy. And so correcting the record is where you start, for sure. But I think, all right, reframe the question, because now I'm off on a tangent.
Very good. How has the issue of book banning and censorship impacted your library's operation and policies?
Yeah. So again, it starts with the policies. Thank you. I wanted to make sure I was on the right track. And with those policies, again, looking at the community that you're serving, and are they serving the community appropriately? Because every policy is not going to be the same for every city, determined by your community's values as well. So that's a key thing too, is we do share our resources amongst ourselves, but we evaluate them as well for how they fit with our communities. And I think anyone in that leadership role should be doing that from the start of any evaluation process. So for me personally, that's how I approach not just censorship, but overall how we do operating business. And again, risk management, risk assessment. Oh, if you don't have your little devil on the one shoulder telling you what is the worst possible scenario, find that friend in your organization to do that for you, and review the policies or procedures for those loopholes or those infractions that may come from them. Because we all have that pessimistic person who can definitely pull out a negative scenario out of the text and review it and then evaluate. And again, you role play. What is the reality that this will happen and things like that, to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of it before you implement it. But again, making sure that everyone's aware of when it starts and when the other one stops is key as well. So censorship itself, being that it seems relatively new, I will get to, I have bagged for a reason, I have brought some books, but it actually isn't new. It's been around since the start of information being shared. Different people have always been trying to harbor their own information. I mean, we even see it in institutional knowledge. People, I'm about to retire, and no, I'm going to shred every file. No, I'm not going to give that off to who's coming in after me. No. That's a form of censorship. That is a form of handicapping the person who is going into. So there's variations to it, and even within the realm of libraries, there's variations. One of the things with censorship that I don't know that people are really thinking about, but it's in line with policies and operations, there's new versions of books being printed after the authors have passed that have been altered. And some of them are children's books. I'll allow her to speak more on that because that's her realm. However, those are things that we still have to keep an eye out for. We still have to be part of those conversations and evaluate. Now, how does this impact? Are we going to keep a 1999 version of, is it Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? Which one was it? Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, all the Willy Wonkas, all the, what's his name? For some reason, I'm blanking.
Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl's whole set has been updated. Mm-hmm. So do you keep an old version as well as a new version in your collection because of transparency? These are things that we have to consider. On top of that, do we have the space to keep both versions? So things are happening all around for it.
I touched on a little bit that we did have some good impacts. We are definitely more united, and we collaborate more on our book orders, which was a good thing. It has also made more paperwork for us. Now when we place our orders for the schools, we have to have it approved by 3 other librarians. Mm-hmm. And that's just to kind of, make sure that we're all on the same page. So it's good in some ways, but at the same time, it takes a lot longer to get your orders placed. Mm-hmm. We also do this something where it's called weeding, when you take books that are outdated off the shelf. And now we have to, for every book that we take off the shelf, we have to code why we removed it, mm-hmm. And give it to the board. So there's more checks and balances in place because of this now. I don't think it's all bad, it's just more paperwork.
Exactly.
One of the things that's been great is that we are talking more, because we will discover books that are like, there's a trend in publishing to make spicy romances with very cutesy covers. And for a high school librarian, I have kids requesting those books all the time. And what's great is that when I find out one of those, I tell my other high school librarians, I was like, hey, I've heard of this book, be on the lookout for it. It is not really high school appropriate. Mm-hmm. Because publishers are
they're
getting a little sneaky with it. Because I had a teacher come, they're like, yeah, I read it. No. which is something that people don't always know, is that I tell kids no all the time. And they'll come in there and go, you get this? And I was just like, ooh, too spicy. And so we treat it with funny. But we do have things that we follow when we purchase books.
Exactly.
Which sometimes I think in the public they think that we don't. But so those checks and balances have been a good impact. What I worry about is the ones where librarians are self-censoring to avoid conflict, because that part is harder to track. We do look at our library collections. There's like automatic ways to analyze for diversity and for those subjects, and so we can look at those and look at the areas that we need to improve, because I don't want people to avoid books that maybe touch on addressing racism, because they're afraid that maybe it will trigger a book challenge. I was like, we want to make sure we're not doing that. And that's the more, it's hard to make a policy about that.
That's where I say challenge accepted.
Yeah, so the policies aren't bad. They just, make it a little bit more work sometimes.
My next question for all my panelists is, how do you engage with the community about the importance of diverse viewpoints and access to free information through your libraries?
I mean, I do this. I go out and I talk to people one-on-one. I think that's the best and easiest way to do it, because it's the easiest way to dispel people's individual, unique qualifiers that they're trying to understand better about our systems or about what we're doing or why we're doing certain things. It's hard to answer a group's question because a group doesn't have a question. They're all different questions. That's why lines form at groups. It's not because they all have the same thoughts. And I think that it's very... it's the way that I've viewed it since I've even joined libraries is libraries have had a history of not knowing how to advocate for themselves. Mm-hmm. And they advocate for everybody else. And the issue is now they don't know how to turn it in on themselves, because again, we want to give. We don't want the recognition. We want to be able to just do our jobs and go home and be proud of the work that we're doing. But when you look at what libraries what's happening with libraries, the thought that we are only books is the big thing. And that's why book challenges, I feel, are a bigger thing now, is because that's what people are hanging on to, is that concept that we are only books. And so my job is to change people's perceptions on that. It's not books. We never were actually supposed to be about just books. Libraries were created to have debates. They were information exchange locations. Just put into one word. So just because the information's route has changed to digital formats, that is the hanger on of past beliefs of libraries is that it's only books. The books are just the modality of expression. The information is the core of what we do. It doesn't matter the format that that information takes. We want to share it with you. And I think that that's one of the biggest challenges for librarians themselves currently is returning to the information aspect, not just the modalities of our service, but the core of it.
So I think most of my interactions are with students and sometimes with parents individually. And then I also speak at events like this. The Michigan PTA Association had a conference a couple weeks ago. I went and spoke there with a group of librarians. I always felt like last year I did not speak at the board meetings. And sometimes I think, I don't know if it would have been worse or if it would have helped. I felt that I'd become a very controversial figure for a little while. I was their favorite person to hate sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, they weren't listening. Is it gonna make it worse? Mm-hmm. So I haven't, and the people that were challenging the books never spoke to me last year. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things, they spoke about me a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I felt, I kind of, was like, I didn't think I was emotionally, am I just going to be tortured more by this? So I just kind of tried to take the high road on it. I'm hoping that going forward, we can have more of a conversation instead of just a one-sided, where people were just bad-mouthing librarians and libraries. Because they didn't want to hear anything different, I felt. It was kind of just, there was a lot of yelling. Anyone who watched the board meeting saw it was a lot of yelling. But where I think my strength is with individual conversations with people in those, come talk to me about the library. I'll show you what we can do and what we do, what our goals are.
If I can add,
and director hat, not just librarian hat, that's part of it. As a director, I am actively talking with City Council. I'm actively at City Council in the wings, even if it's not necessarily something of my item that's on there. My presence is there because if it is something that can tie into the library or how we do outreach or how we improve our services, I want to know about it and I want to be able to be present and take action sooner. Oftentimes, the 9-to-5 schedule is what people stick to, and in certain positions, I think that that's where your flexibility needs to come through, being available for these types of meetings or opportunities to talk with not only your community, but to represent the library appropriately, and that's sort of the director side of what I was saying earlier about advocating for ourselves. That's also with the institutions. A librarian promoted up to director may not know that they should be attending City Council and maybe should be doing quarterly or every 6 months, hey, this is what we've done in the past quarter, past half a year. This is how we're doing, this is where we're going, to address the community in these appropriate places. Similar to that, and not knowing if you're comfortable in those spaces or even welcome in those spaces. So opening those conversations happens by having it first with somebody. And that's where I say being in the community is the best way to get these conversations and having them take some skin.
I just wanted to add, the community members that did speak at the board meeting last year, I was so thankful for them because they had a huge impact because their voices were heard. The school district was hearing me separately, so they knew what my position. But the community members' support was huge because they were getting the perspective that not everyone agreed.
So thank you to everyone.
Yeah, I think one thing I would like to add is through my research for the past 3 years, I've interviewed dozens of educators and librarians throughout the United States. And one of the biggest concerns that they tell me is they're really, really disappointed about how the educator and parent relationship has been affected. Parents, and I'm going to use my mother as an example here. I come from a religious conservative household, and we had religious rules for me growing up. I couldn't eat meat in the cafeteria, for example, that was not halal or something. my parents could go to my educators and we would talk about it. They would figure something out. They would offer alternatives for me. It was possible because my parents spoke to the educators and they worked out something together. Another thing when it comes to books and reading, did my mother censor material from me growing up? Absolutely. She didn't let me read like the Twilight books at like 9 years old, okay? She didn't let me do that. But that's because she read the material and she worked with the librarians to decide what was age appropriate for me. One of the biggest problems that I see with the advocacy organizations for book banning is that they tend to demonize educators, bypass parents, and try to impose their own beliefs, right, which tend to be, truthfully speaking, white supremacist in nature. And unfortunately, that's one of the biggest effects that I've been seeing in book banning, that I feel people need to realize that this is an organized, targeted effort against librarians. And these groups have been effective in policy as well. I mean, in West Virginia, there was this legislation that thankfully didn't pass, but it wanted to criminalize librarians if they were found distributing material to a minor, obscene material. And there are so many definitions for this. A child could wander into an adult section and a librarian could be criminally charged. And I feel like people don't realize the effects that have because there are people behind this, not just targets. So I guess my next question would be, how can supporters of educational freedom and access to diverse materials effectively advocate within their communities? And feel free to give examples of what you've seen for people who have already advocated.
I don't know this one already. No, I was like, I feel like I answered this one last time.
So one thing I want to point, I want to highlight, and from how I look at net libraries, we are Switzerland. Librarians, when we're behind the desk, we're Switzerland. We are neutral. You come up and we're going to ask you the same question as the person behind you. How can I help you today? What you ask of us is confidential. Privacy is very key in our profession as well. However, you're on the other side of the table. So if you have a good experience at the library, you can go chat with your friends about the good experience at the library. You had this conversation or you participated in this event tonight. You go chat with your friends, hey, the library director seems a little crazy because she seems like she has a lot of energy. It's coffee, and that's what's going on. But that's how. That's the only thing that I ask of patrons is, or of our community, is to become a patron of the library. In Dearborn, and I'm going to be very honest with you, I'm very disappointed with the numbers that we have of patrons with library cards in our community. Mm-hmm. Ask your neighbor. Do you got a library card? Let's go to the library. Summer reading is coming up. How many of you are participating? It's open for all ages. It's not just for kids. There's prizes for everyone, except for staff. As we read our books, you know, as on our infinite time that we have. But that's really truly it, is talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends, make sure that the library is a part of your life, to be able to be shared with others and share it appropriately. We have programs for everybody and for such a variety to offer. Look at what we got going on in our calendars. We're wanting to be out there. We're at every summer market this summer. Come say hi, bring your friend over and say, they haven't renewed their card since they were in the third grade. I don't know, it's red. Do you still service this card? You know, and if you have a red card, kudos. I think some of them still work. So that's really, truly what I ask of you guys is just to be patrons and to enjoy the library. And when you are upset with something, talk to us. We are human. We are people. We want to be there for you. And that's what our role is.
One of the things someone had mentioned earlier, we do have the book reconsideration signups. It's basically so we have a list of community members that can be, if there's a book reconsideration, you know, you might get called to read the book. So they do you have to sign up every fall. So if you signed up before, just in September, sign up again. It's a quick Google form. That always helps us. One of the things is people don't know how thin the librarians are spread. Mm. Because...
Say it again!
I have worked in certain, like, years I worked in three schools where I was 3 days at the high school, 1 day at an elementary, and then another day at an elementary. And it's a lot to keep track of. And Dearborn's actually pretty fortunate because there are a lot of schools that don't have a library at all. They don't have a librarian. They don't have like even someone to like, you know, to keep the library door open. They might not even have the physical space at all. And people don't really know how much they've been cut. I think it was like 64% since 2008, I think, was a staff reduction.
It was over 50.
Yeah, it was staggering. So, like right now in Dearborn, we are trying to grow the program again, but we're still stretched really thin. Because one day in a school isn't enough to achieve what we really want to do, to build those relationships with students and parents. So that's one of the things that we can always ask, because right now they're looking at next year how they're going to staff the libraries, and I still don't even know that answer for what classes we're going to teach next year. So just, you know, if you hear things that, you know, coming out, because they know that I want to have libraries, but they need to hear from people in the community also. Because I know, like, every time there's been, like, tried to cut to music, the difference has been community response. They're like, no, don't cut the music program. That's really important. So just make sure that you're listening to those things at the school board, and if you hear it, you know, to support libraries, because it's a rough job at times. But we do love it. I truly believe in the power of libraries. I think it's really important, and that's why we do the hard job.
Awesome. Yeah. So, you know, I think for folks who do support intellectual freedom, who are standing up against censorship, thinking about it from, you know, a legislative perspective, I would encourage folks to reach out to their state representative, their state senator. If I am your state representative, you probably know where I stand on this issue. But, you know, there are a lot of folks across the political spectrum who take a look at this issue and probably think, man, you know, trying to ban books seems really maybe archaic. It seems scary. You know, it's not something that I would support or want to see happen. But they need to hear that from the people in their community, right? A lot of times, like we were mentioning earlier, how coordinated this effort is, right? And sometimes it's coordinated by people or groups that aren't even from your immediate community. Sometimes they're from a completely different state, right? So people need to hear from folks in their community, the people they represent, the people who sent them to Lansing or City Council or wherever it might be. They need to hear from folks, hey, you know what? There might be a loud, vocal minority of people who want censorship, who want to ban books, but there are more people who want access to books. They want intellectual freedom. And I believe that that is the truth. I think we see that in Michigan. We see that across the country. But we need people who support intellectual freedom and access to books to speak up and be loud in a positive way, in an empowering way. It's really important. I think some elected officials need to hear that. Some people need that nudge. So I think that's important. Whether that's, you know, sending an email to your state rep, state senator, council member, mayor, whoever it is. Whether that's requesting a meeting with them, attending a public meeting like this or a city council meeting. These things are really critical, and these are ways that you can engage. If you're an elected official, you should be having public meetings, coffee hours, events like this. And I would just encourage folks in this room and beyond, you know, I think when you leave here today, if you can even reach out to two or three friends or neighbors and make sure they know who their elected officials are, make sure they know how to contact folks, encourage them to join the league. That's a great way to get engaged, right? Making sure that people know how to contact folks who are in positions of decision-making power. I think that's really important. We can't afford to just sit back and be silent and think good thoughts in the comfort of our own homes, right? We have to be uncomfortable in spaces. And I think that's really important when you're really advocating for that intellectual freedom and access to books.
Thank you all. These were all amazing responses. And I guess just from like a young person's perspective, I work a lot in like student voting, student registration, basically acting on my position when Secretary Benson appointed me was to act as a bridge between students, my classmates, and legislators. biggest thing when I talk to my classmates is like, well, they're a legislator. How can I talk to them? They kind of seem these ivory towers that students don't really feel like they can access. So one of my biggest roles has been really advocacy and awareness, like email your local legislator, especially in local politics, because those are the ones that tend to be neglected the most and have the least amount of participation. I mean, if a local representative gets like 20 emails about an issue, their staff is going to tell them, you got 20 emails today. You need to pay attention to this. So it is very important to highlight, you know, the effect of local advocacy and talking to your legislators. Thank you to all our amazing panelists. I appreciate all your responses tonight. I do want to end our panel for tonight on like one quick note with some statistics from the Michigan Library Association. They conducted a survey of library patrons throughout the state of Michigan. And they found that 71%, which was a solid majority of respondents, gave their local libraries in Michigan, including their local public libraries, a positive rating. Only 8% gave a negative rating, and 21% were undecided. And a solid 83% majority of respondents support state legislation that would protect the right of the public to read what they wish in their local libraries and not have book bans. And this is an opinion from all sides of the political aisle. It includes 95% of Democrats, 89% of Independents, and 70% of Republicans support the freedom to read and let people choose what they want to see in their local libraries. I think one very important thing to highlight is when you advocate to use the government as a weapon for censorship, I feel like a lot of people don't notice that some people use that weapon against you. And that leads to culture wars. It leads to the very division that we see in our libraries. So I think it's very important that we stand up to censorship, because part of my research for the past 3 years is looking at historical trends of book banning. Nazi Germany targeted librarians and targeted Jewish professors. It got rid of all those materials. In fascist Italy, they got rid of materials as well. My point being, book banners have never been on the good side of history. And I think it's very important to note that. So I know Jen wanted to make some closing remarks.
Is it possible for questions?
What time is it?
Did we have any questions?
Yes.
If you're closing,
we do have, I believe, like 10 minutes for Q&A.
I have a couple of questions about how censorship impacts both students and teachers. Mm-hmm. Students, if they're a member of the targeted population, mm-hmm. how much are they feeling safe now? And are the schools doing to make sure that they're safe? And two, how much has this impacted the ability of teachers to talk about controversial issues and to feel safe as an educator in being able to explore those things and to discuss them within their classrooms? Because I suspect that a lot of teachers feel like, because of this, I can't speak up about these things, about racism, about slavery, about inclusion. Immigration, inclusion, any, people that are different than the norm. And I just wonder how much that's impacting and how much that you see that impacting both students and teachers.
So I can answer your question from a student perspective, because based on my research, a lot of has been around that. 40%, according to PEN America, 40% of all book bans target authors and people, stories of people of color. Some of that, like Aaron mentioned, was the story of Rosa Parks in Florida and history textbooks. Some examples I have seen was in New York, where a lady who runs little free libraries, was asked to remove material from a local elementary, and she found the books were about immigrant children telling their stories living between two border towns, Tijuana and the American side. I think it is very demoralizing when you see a child's stories removed from a library. And I've seen a lot of arguments that, well, if you can buy it on Amazon, one day shipping, it's not really banned. But the truth is like, I grew up as a poor kid. I did not have access to library materials. My mother took me to the library, and she would let me choose 10 books that I wanted to read. My mother could not buy all of those for me. So I saw myself in libraries, and it really built who I am today. And I feel like poor kids should have the right to read. And I feel like that's an important part of the conversation that should be included as well.
But the LGBTQ population was the targeted population to a large extent in Dearborn. And are they protected, and are teachers in the school systems feeling like, I can't talk about these things?
I think that's a really good point. I will hand it over to them as well. So yeah, I'll let you take it over.
Now with the schools.
I would say, yeah, there is a lot of pressure that we are supposed to be Switzerland, and that's a hard thing because kids want to talk. I will tell you that in the library, everyone knows, even though there's no like outward symbols, they're very comfortable with talking to me. And I had a lot of conversations last year because it became a thing. Is the only Dewey number they knew was where we had the nonfiction books about gay families and about, you know, the history of the Pride movement. Because then they would go find them and then put them in display at different places, or that it became kind of a joke. And then I would pull those students aside. I was like, that's not how we treat people. And so I had to have a lot of those conversations that are hard conversations because of that, because they were watching kind of what was happening in the community and the things that were written on signs, and it almost kind of, they felt like empowered to do those things. But I had a lot of conversations, less like, I'm not from Michigan. I lived all over the place. I was a military brat. And I said, I will tell you that where the school I taught in Maryland, we only had one Muslim family, and when the oldest daughter started wearing hijab, do you think I let people make fun of her? And they were like, oh. I was like, we don't make fun of people for who they are. That's not a good thing to do. And the principal has been very supportive as well. It's just that when you've had to have those hard conversations, it's very difficult with also maintaining the Switzerland, because internally, you know, you're just like, well, I want to say so much, but you're trying to make it a learning moment for the students about focusing on, even if your religious beliefs are different, that doesn't give us the right to make fun of people and make, you know, treat these books like they're a joke. But there's a lot of work to still be done. But I have conversations with students all like that in the library all the time. And I think that's because I've been there for a while, and so we have those good relationships. And it's been much better this year. So I feel like we've made progress. But there's still, obviously, room to grow.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
I just have a comment. John Oliver just did a whole thing on libraries this week. I don't know if you've seen it. It's hilarious. I think you'll all enjoy it.
I just want to reiterate with the League of Women Voters, we're going to probably have people running for the school board next year. And we'll be putting out what they stand for. And that will be another thing for us to encourage people to vote. Public service announcement.
Yeah. Looking on the bright side of like the bright side of book banning, it's the one good thing it's done is have had people pay attention to school board elections. People are starting to realize about the importance of local elections. So yeah, thank you for doing that. And yeah, it's always awesome to have members of the community represent what they believe in.
Thank you. I want to use a term that Betty used here a little earlier, that this information exchange location is just been very lucky to have these four panelists that we have here this evening. So I want to thank all of our panelists. I want to thank you for
you know, leading the panel. Erin, thank you. Betty, Nicole, thank you for your perspectives. And thank you for taking the time to come here this evening and talk to us about this important and crucial topic. I also want to thank our Vice President and Advocacy Chair, Karen Jones, for all of her incredible hard work that she's been doing. Karen, I correct me if I'm wrong, I actually think you started working on this program back in January and really doing a wonderful job and working with the rest of our advocacy committee. And you'll tell me if I'm missing anyone. I believe that our members of our committee are Laura, Marlene, Jerry, and Connie, and Betsy. Thank you. I think Erin said this. Thank you for giving the legal plug too, because that was you must have been looking at my remarks here. If anyone is interested in learning more about the league or joining us, please talk to me or anybody else here. We'll be happy to talk to you. There are some members here, but I also see a number of faces here who aren't members, and we would love you to join us.
You've been listening to a discussion on censorship in education right here on the WHFR Journal. Thanks to the League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, for this special presentation. That'll wrap up today's journal. Have a great day and a wonderful weekend.
And from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists. Coming up, we have got Kitty Love with Highway 61. Stay with us.
Detroit West Side suburbs downriver. Tune in locally to 89.3, the station making waves. Join me, Sean Daniel, Monday, 9 to 11 p.m. with Beats to the Rhymes, the only radio show where we focus on beats and lyrics, Detroit music, and underground hip hop. Listen worldwide online at WHFR.FM, Dearborn, Detroit.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
All the time, that's where my baby stays.